Good morning. This is Robin Shanti, and our guest this morning is Beau Rinaldi. Beau calls himself a bloodless revolutionary, and he believes that the only way out of this matrix of corporatocracy we find ourselves in is by adopting a plant-based lifestyle. He's one of the pioneers of the organic movement in the U.S., and he's been a vegan since 1960. We're going to talk about a little bit, all over the place here, but Beau, why don't you start off and tell us what made you a vegan and a little bit about your story.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here, and it's great to be on KBOO once again. First, a disclaimer, we're going to talk a lot about probably things that can help us physically and mentally and emotionally, and these are my own stories, so no medical advice will be given here. And also, in terms of businesses, people might know I'm part of the Blossoming Lotus restaurant and also Vegan Fusion, and this is not representative of anything there, but a shout-out and a hello to everybody. This is, and thank you all for your great support, this is, more than anything, a personal story. And I'm motivated and activated to be here with you to share that. In 1960, when I was 12 years old, I had severe asthma and allergies. I was in the L.A. basin. There was a lot of smog alerts going on. And I couldn't breathe. I had severe asthma and allergies. My parents took me to Scripps Institute, to the Mayo Clinic, to any doctor that possibly could help me, and no one could help us. So I couldn't breathe. As a 12-year-old kid, she took me to the Seventh-day Adventist doctor in the area, and that doctor gave my mother the book Back to Eden. Within 2 weeks of reading the book Back to Eden, I adopted the ideas that he had there, cutting out wheat, milk, dairy, eggs, and also the herbal formulas that he had in the back of the book. The book's still in print, Jethro Kloss, 1939. Everyone probably knows about it. Within 2 weeks, I was cured of my asthma and my allergies. I've never been sick since. I became a vegan and an herbalist, and I had no idea what those things were.
Well, I want to give out the phone number here because this is a call-in show. It's 503-231-8187. So here you go. You become a vegan. You've been doing that since the 1960s, and for you, food is your activism. Mm. Can you talk about that a little bit and
Right. What I deduced as a child now, you know, we're bringing food into the house. We have cashews, which just were imported from Mozambique. There is no organic food movement. There are no health food stores. Even in Southern California, there's one restaurant, two stores. It's pretty limited. There was a kind of a nature boy movement going on there. Gypsy Boots was part of it, Jack LaLanne, et cetera. But their thing was eat the donut whole, not the donut. You know, they were really... And they were in the orchards, and they were the first people to really show me that he who controls the food controls the people. As Napoleon said, he who controls the food rules the people. And so what we came upon in the 60s, now I'm in the Southern California 60s, I'm the vegan chef, and I am the herbalist of the Southern California 60s, otherwise known as kind of the love-in movement. And I'm a hippie, and I'm a really, I think, kind of an illuminated person because of certain things that we're doing at that time, whether it's meditation or otherwise, and I feel like we have to empower ourselves. And as I was looking into it more deeply, we realized, as we're starting to aggregate in these love-ins, that if we fed the people, we could free the people. We used to say you could not fuel a revolution on an empty stomach. And so we learned how to feed ourselves for 50 cents a meal, dollar a meal, because we had no money, of course. And we learned how to eat lower down the food chain. And lo and behold, we found that if we were eating turnips and rutabagas, cabbages and cashews, we didn't have any disease. We had perfect weight. We were glowing. We smelled good. People liked us. Our intuitive centers started to open. Our minds were open. Our bodies were open. And so that thus began what I consider to be the early organic movement, which started really around 1964 with Erewhon and Paul Hawken. And shout out to everybody that's part of that. Joel Wolner might be listening to that. He's part of this. His kids live in this town. We have the uprising of that movement. And it became clear to me and abundant to me that I had to study it. So I learned about a group from the 1700s in England called the Diggers. And can we talk about that for a second?
Sure. A lot of people out there, especially younger people, may not be familiar not only with the 1700 Diggers, but the revival that happened.
Right. We call ourselves the New Diggers. What happened was Peter Coyote, an actor that's still alive today, great actor, he had the same kind of awareness. So the diggers studied Pythagoras, and they were brought this whole idea of being vegans over kind of the bridge from India and from Greece and Italy from these ancient thinkers, and Pythagoras being kind of the leader of these thinkers. And they deduced that whoever could feed the people could free the people. So Gerard Winstanley in 1740, 1760, right in there, started a group called the Diggers. And they were called the True Levelers. They believed that if everybody had a little bit of land and could grow their own food, they could free themselves of the imperialistic domination of what the king was putting on them. And what the king was putting on them was taxation. The kings would come around on their horses. They'd take the women and the gold and the animals, whatever they could get. That'd be a taxation. So they moved out, the diggers, and sometimes called the new diggers now, moved out to the edges of the forest on public property and started growing their rutabagas and their turnips and their cabbages. They were plant-based. They fed each other. There were hundreds of them. And when the king came around, they had no goats. They had no gold. The women were kind of out in the forest and not probably the most attractive of all the people out there because they're working really hard in the gardens. This is truth. And the diggers really became this model of our group in the 60s where we saw food as activism when we call ourselves bloodless revolutionaries. And that term comes from Gerard Winstanley. And therefore, modern-day veganism is seen as an anti-imperialistic movement because you do not need to be part of the corporatocracy of food systems, the taxation system, the medical system, or anything else, because you're relatively liberated by eating a plant-based lifestyle. And so light started to go on for lots of people, and that kind of bore the foundations of the early kind of PETA and the early vegan movement, and why, still to this day, we're highly demonized.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This whole idea of food sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Controlling where our food comes from, what food we're eating. You know, there's all these battles going on with GMOs and all that stuff. But you have a philosophy that people really can control their own food. Why don't you talk about that?
Right. One thing that we did, basically what happened to me is in the late 70s, I just got out of the whole movement. I thought we were all going to be living on communes and eating organic food and freely loving each other. We had babies in tree houses for real, you know, Mexico, Hawaii, California. And so what happened was I just felt like to make some money and to make a true living for myself, I got into technology. Luckily, I was in Silicon Valley kind of at the boom time, and I was able to retire out of technology in 1999. And when I got back into kind of understanding what was going on with our food system more deeply, I was amazed that the vegan movement was even more demonized than ever, less embraced than ever. This is the year 2000 or so. And so we started to put a lot of our energy into opening up our restaurants, our publishing company, our websites, our classes, everything to try to inform people about a plant-based lifestyle. And the train of thought came to us that if you could feed people for very inexpensively, you could help free people so they could be more creative, they could be happier, healthier individuals, kids could be more engaged. And as a 12-year-old kid, I was always involved, you know, with how I could help children, since that's when I came onto this. And my intuitive nature just said that what we had to do was find a way to feed people inexpensively and go to places where there's lots of farmers, where we can go to market quickly and then take that food and take zucchinis and turn it into live pasta. Since, you know, I've been a fruitarian in 1970, lived in South America, been a vegan for 51 years. I've tried everything under the sun. I know a lot about a lot of things, still learning, of course. But that live food, and whether it's cooked food or live food or whatever, as long as it's good, organic, fresh food, we're going to fuel ourselves. We're going to be healthier, and we can be empowered. So, Robin, thanks for asking the question. Kauai, Hawaii, which is where one of our focus areas are, down in Ecuador, where we have a lot of land and we do a lot of work there. And, of course, Portland, Oregon, where we try to support as many organic farmers as possible. We're now interested in this concept of food sovereignty, meaning that in any particular area, we do not want GMOs here. We do not want any means that are not sustainable. We do not want neurodisruptors in our system, such as pesticides, herbicides, metals, etc., in our food supply, water supply, air supply. And we call on everybody, whether in the DEQ, whether they're working for the government or the man, whether they're on an organic farm right now, to think about sustainable means. As goes our topsoil, as Rachel Carson would say, so goes our humanity. And we want to be returning that plant matter back to the earth, otherwise known as biodynamic farming, and we want to use organic means wherever possible in the food that we deliver to the people.
If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here at 503-231-8187. You know, a lot of people say that, and I know personally, I say that, you know, when the stuff hits the fan, I'm really glad that I'm in Portland because we have a lot of natural resources. People can band together. A few weeks ago, I have my whole front yard. I've raised beds and I grow food. And one of my neighbors was walking by and we're just talking on the sidewalk and he just looks at me and he says, you know, we could grow a lot of food on this block if we needed to. And I thought, wow, you know, other people are thinking the same thing I'm thinking. And so that whole issue, I think, is very present in people's minds, especially with all the economic craziness that's going on right now. Progressives especially, you know, we feel like we're being just thrown under the bus, you know, politically. So this is a great, you know, way that we can take back some control and some sovereignty. I want to talk about the whole issue that a lot of people out there, organic food, for instance, can be really looked at as a class issue and a classist issue. So what do you say to people, you know, who say, look, I can't afford organic food. It's a great idea, but, you know, I'm on food stamps. I can't do it. What would you say to that?
Great question, Robin. Thanks. I love these questions. First of all, if you grow your own food, you'll start to realize how much you should love your farmer because it's a freaking lot of work, okay? And then, of course, you're not going to get into the variety of foods that you want, so you have to learn how to barter. And then you might end up with 100 pounds of cabbages, and they might have 100 pounds of zucchini. You need to learn how to make those items. So that's what we try to teach people at the veganfusion.com website, where we go around the world doing it. And we offer these lessons for pay or for exchange or online or whatever it takes, because what I would say to people that feel that organic food is classist is that food is classist. That's the main thing. So if you ask kids where food comes from, 70% of them will say the supermarket. 90% of our food dollar is spent on packaged foods. Food does not come out of a supermarket. Food is not packaged. Yet everybody knows that, you and I included, but very few people would know like the history of a Bircher Benner salad or how to be a hygienist or what is, you know, why even Fit for Life was there. And these are early concepts of how to do graded meals or fresh live meals, etc. And whether you go to a farmer's market or a co-op or you buy your produce at the big box, you know, organic stores, whether it's local chains or WF or TJ's or whatever, you'll find that if you stay with the fruits and vegetables you check out, probably you'll spend about $20 per person on fruits, grains, seeds, nuts, herbs per week.
Okay? For how many meals?
For that would be 21 meals, 3 by 7. Okay, so you can feed yourself for about $1 a meal. If you learn how to make a Waldorf salad, if you learn how to make a sauerkraut, if you learn how to make a pot of brown rice with some, you know, umeboshi plum or something, by the time you're done, if you really do this in a way that's conscious, you could do it for $1 a meal. But you have to kind of know some of the things that we like to show people. So we're not, although we're kind of big in the organic movement, it's kind of like it's so commercialized now, you have to stay lower down the food system. Learn what a kohlrabi is. Make a rutabaga ravioli. Gather nuts that are local to your area. Actually, big on foraging. Our next book, I have another book coming out from Penguin, A Complete Idiot's Guide book. And part of it is going to be on foraging. And learn what lamb's quarter is all about, plantain, sorrel, where to get it. And there's lots of things we can talk about to the people here about that. It is classist, but it's not organic food. It's food is classist. And the idea is to, and this goes back to the true levelers, the diggers, to make sure that we feed our people. So that's why these conversations are interesting to me, because if I throw a feast and people kind of be drooling over the food, I'm going to make sure it's as local as possible, all organic, of course, very down the food chain. And they're going to go, how much did this cost? I'm going to go, you know, I don't know, about $1, couple dollars per person. And then, of course, you can throw in more exotics. You know, you can add in things from around the world. You can add in your certain kinds of superfoods, et cetera, as far as you want to go. But to me, what I learned a long time ago is all plant-based foods are superfoods. Hmm. And that goes back from being a Pythagorean.
Well, we do have a caller on the line. Lewis, you want to join the conversation here?
Yeah, well, of course, life is more than taking in calories. Our protein sources, it has to do with how one whiles one's life away otherwise, and not distracting from the focus of the topic. But implicit in all that you're saying, if a person wants to live a life with the enrichment, so to speak, other than nutritional enrichment or enrichment of wilderness experience, species diversity and all of that, it implicit in everything you're saying is balancing the ratio of population to resources of all kinds. And again, that right away brings us to the host of beliefs that have people populating at tremendous rates, and the current unsustainability of the existing population we have. So it seems like to me, unless you put what you're saying in the context of that, or addressing those things simultaneously, that it's a pointless conversation. So thank you. Bye.
Thanks for your comments. And I want to give the phone number quickly one more time, 503-231-8187. And please join the conversation. Bo, do you want to respond to Lewis?
Well, Lewis, thank you. It's I think the point's well taken. It's a pointless conversation if we pair us as a humanity because of lack of resources. My concept of we might perish as a humanity if we do not adopt a plant-based lifestyle is a futile conversation. And I basically could be, at any given time, absorbed by the earth or up in a nuclear holocaust. So it would, again, become a pointless conversation. But to the point, I met Alvin Toffler one time. I was trained by Carl Sagan when I went to school at UCLA. He taught a metaphysical education class. There was about 600 of us in the class. What we learned about is that we do have a if we had peak oil and we have peak beef, we kind of have peak resources everywhere. We've kind of peaked out. So there's still enough oxygen on this planet, and there's still enough water on this planet, still enough bright people like yourself. I think the message would be the point of the conversation is how do we survive as a humanity if we're in China or India or anywhere, and it's not going to be through processed foods and drugs. So these Chinese kids, these Indian kids, they now have the earliest adoption of diabetes, of early onset childhood diabetes of any kids in humanity. So basically, Michio Kushi, who brought together something known as the Great Principle, which became something known as macrobiotics, spoke to the fact that there is famine. There are great principles here where massive amounts of people will die because of whatever reason, whether it's earth changes or, you know, disease or whatever. And I just put my faith kind of in whether it's Gaia, Goddess, the Great Beyond, Stardust, Alien Power, I don't know. But it's a little bit above our pay grade, Lewis, to know what to do about that. They'll try to govern for it, but I think everybody has to be the change.
Well, I think we might have another caller on the line here. JB, would you like to join the conversation with Bo Rinaldi?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I'm finding this conversation very interesting. My husband and I recently moved up to Southern Washington, near Mount St. Helens, and we are planting a very large garden. And we're living in a teepee, actually.
Wow.
More or less completely off the grid. And it's interesting because he was talking about this movement that took place in the 60s and the early 70s, and it was very active. And I feel like we're actually divided from the more active progressive movement these days, my husband and I, and that a lot of the back to land and planting your own garden and growing your own food has become seen as kind of this, like, novelty almost,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to something that's very necessary to activate and get, you know, get all of this going. You know,
mm-hmm.
like you pointed out, growing food is very hard, and growing food organically is even more difficult. We've dug everything by hand. So I just wanted to, you know, throw it out there that buying organic and, you know, shopping from the farmer's market is great, but we really need more people who are interested to be out there doing this,
mm-hmm.
Living a life that's, you know, quite frankly harder, but Well, harder relatively. It's healthier, it's more vibrant, it's more energized, it's more beautiful by far than living in the city, and I know I was born and raised in the city. So I just wanted to throw it out there that we really need to get that movement going again, as well as the consumer side of the movement, you know?
Thanks, Shaby. That's a great point.
Yeah, thank you.
So I have a comment, as you could imagine. My comment is this. If we go back to the earth or back to the land, it'll come out on Fox News as being like really quaint. You know, how quaint is that? If we take a look at trying to return to our roots or whatever, doing urban farming or whatever, people get arrested for growing too many vegetables in their front lawn right now. I do believe organic farming, however, JB, is a lot easier than, say, subsidized farming or Monsanto-driven or Archer Midland Daniels-oriented farming, in that it's cheaper. And if we mulch our food byproducts, you know, the leaves that are the offshoots of the different plantings, if we mulch into the soil has a tendency to give back. And so if you grow enough food, enough seasons, your soil becomes so rich. It's like rich in loamy. You have lots of worms in there. Food will start sprouting out of it. So I don't picture a world so much where we're going to have gardens growing everywhere and everyone like back to the land. I think that time has passed us. I think with technology, and I do believe technology has failed us as a humanity, and I know a lot about technology, I think. I do believe that there'll be certain people that will be able to pop up everywhere and have telecommunication systems and interactivity, even in your teepee. You might even have wireless, who knows, a wireless teepee, you know. We'll find that there'll be some among us that will be astrologers. There'll be some among us that will be tarot readers. There'll be some among us that will be healers. There'll be some among us that will be farmers. And I think we can barter. We can exchange. We can look to forming smaller communities within our communities, larger communities within those other communities, so that people get the connection. As Pythagoras said, as he learned from the rishis in India in 560 BC, the man-to-plant connection is the quickest way to your self-realization and freedom as a human.
What are some of the other theories that Pythagoras had around plant-based food?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so Pythagoras, it all kind of starts with Pythagoras and his wife, Theanu, actually. So Pythagoras, there's no written word on Pythagoras. If you look, he didn't write anything. It's scribes, and people wrote about him, and we can get into kind of the history of Pythagoras. But it's 562, Samos, Greece, Island. He's 6 foot tall. He's seen as a goddess of a man. He did exist. His wife actually came up with the theory of pi, not him, which would be the golden mean, which would be kind of the foundation of maybe something like the Da Vinci Code or that type of thing. Leonardo da Vinci, of course, was a vegan and was a big Pythagorean. So anyway, Pythagoras thought that the whole universe could be quantified in numbers. He walks to India with his group to meet the rishis. The rishis are above the Brahmins, okay? They are these light beings that live forever. They're translucent beings. They tell Pythagoras that by adopting a plant-based lifestyle, understanding the cellular interaction between your own body and the plant body, that this is a regenerative system that can fuel your body for as long as you like. Pythagoras lived to be 100 years old. Okay. He has the 33 edicts of Pythagoras. Now, it's been co-opted by other people if you look up 33 edicts, but it all comes from Pythagoras. So the beginning of mysticism, as above, so below, comes from Pythagoras. All truths or half-truths come from Pythagoras. So you can't believe anything you hear. You have to adopt it for yourself to know it, is what that would mean. The swing to the left is equal to the swing to the right. These are the edicts of Pythagoras. He taught that the law of seven is what is prevalent on planet Earth. He certainly understood the stars and time and other things. But in terms of mathematics on Earth, sound, color, plants, rocks and minerals, animals, everything is in a law of seven. So there were seven colors in the rainbow, seven notes to make up an octave. So the eighth note is the next octave. And that there's seven colors in the plants for the different nutritional aspects of what the plant brings. So every color of the plant brings a different aspect to your body to regenerate your cellular being. Green for chlorophyll, of course, now is lutein. And chlorophyll is synonymous with blood, of course. It's the same biochemistry, essentially. We can talk more about that if you like. And now today, modern science is saying, and the term is phenols, and this comes from superfood theory, Dr. Stephen Pratt, that, you know, if it's orange, it'll be carotenoids. If it's reds, it's lycopenes. But there's about 3,000 to 4,000 phenols in the plant kingdom. And maybe we've identified about 10% of these. As a matter of fact, OHSU, major doctor by the name of William Connor, who just passed away actually this year, was a big researcher in the zeaxanthins and the purples and this type of thing because of the Tarahumara Indians in Copper King, and it would run forever, that are plant-based native tribe. And I think Pythagoras, not only was he way ahead of his time, he was a cosmic being. And he was like one of these beings, I think, came to Earth to be a clear-like channel of these things that I learned as a kid because here I am in geometry class. I'm the only vegetarian in the friggin' probably town of L.A. where I am in North Hollywood. And it's like there's Pythagoras, because you look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is also kind of quaint. I don't think there's a lot of those around anymore. And there's – who's a vegetarian? Well, there's Albert Einstein, you know, and there's Albert Schweitzer. There's Mohandas Gandhi. And they're all incredible. And there's Pythagoras. And William Connor was actually in there too.
As you mentioned, Da Vinci.
And Da Vinci. Right. And so I look up Pythagoras. There he is. And I'm learning about whatever the Pythagorean theorem, which is just about like triangles and how, you know, the mathematics work there. And I go, oh, my goodness, Pythagoras taught that on a plant-based diet, your body, and he was basically called the macrophage, your immune system, which at that time was the ability to ward off any disease, was enhanced. So that's why the vegan lifestyle works. It just enhances your immune system. Your body goes, yay.
We've got a couple of callers waiting. Let's take those calls. Another JB is on the line. Hi there.
Hi there. Hey, my question is, if, you know, we slowly convert over to growing a lot of our own food, are we going to see Monsanto coming after us? Like the way they go after the farmers. I heard that farmers weren't allowed to keep their own seed because Monsanto had, you know, rights to so much seed. That's my question.
All right, thanks.
Well, it's already happening. Monsanto's not going after you. Monsanto's trying to control the whole DNA of the plant kingdom. So we need to have heirloom seeds. We need to make sure that we keep our seed. Seed is more important than anything right now, JB. So you're right on it. Down in Ecuador where I was, I was there last week. A lot of subsidized farming, a lot of influence of Monsanto. Those Indians are being given pesticides and seed to grow their product. Seed and pollen, of course, transmigrates across land. So they will control the land and control the food supply. And that's really kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing. We cannot be co-opted by this. We need to make sure that it's not only organic food, which by definition generally means it's not GMO, but we have to make sure that what we're doing in many ways is conscious right now, because if we do not aggregate as a humanity here, they will control us and you will have nothing but disease and nothing but energy problems and nothing but food problems. And the people that sit on the boards, unfortunately, of the largest hospitals and the largest energy companies and the largest food companies and the largest pharmaceutical companies are all the same people. It's an end-to-end solution. As Shinjiko Roshi says, a famous Zen Buddhist, when I feed you a meal, it's not about feeding you a meal. It's about everything. Therefore, food is the end-to-end problem, paradox, solution. And if we don't work with our scientists that are the anti-GMO people, and I don't use a lot of anti-words being kind of this pacifist type person I am, energized, vegan. If we do not do something about it, we will perish as a humanity. They will control us and we will die. And these products that they put out, they are neurodisruptors. They are what's causing things like chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, Alzheimer's, even, I believe, autism. All these diseases, they were not prevalent when I was a child. I watched these things. There's a term called iatrogenic diseases. 5% of our diseases were iatrogenic in the 60s. I would say 70% of our diseases are iatrogenic. Those are diseases caused by the cure. So food is not the cure. Food is what's killing us. Hippocrates did not say food is your medicine. Hippocrates said, make food your medicine. Food is not our medicine. Food is what's killing us. And drugs are what's masking what's killing us.
Mm. We're talking with Bo Rinaldi. This is Robin Shanti for Talk Radio on KBOO Portland. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 503-231-8187. And we'll take another call. Richard, hi, you're on the line.
Good morning. Once again, KBOO, thank you for an outlet for people to speak. Sir, I'm... deeply moved by what you have to say, and I feel little in my comments at times, but once again, it's about Monsanto. To co-opt, the politicians co-opt the culture of life, culture of death, and to me, Monsanto as a political structure is the culture of death. Talk to me, do you know this new to science microscopic fungus in Roundup Ready grain? It goes on and on. Thank you. Thank you.
Amazing people that you have here listening to the show today. Hi, Richard. Thank you for that, man. Okay, so I don't think we can get to the corporation. As a matter of fact, I don't believe corporations exist. I don't believe countries exist. I believe people exist. I believe a biosphere exists, and every one of us makes a difference. So that's number one. Number two is one reason I try to have this as much outreach as I can in this area is I work with many scientists around the world that are combating them in lobbies around the world, most notably Brian Tokar, if he's listening, is Dr. Brian Tokar. He's my favorite speaker in this area to inform us. There'll be nano species. There'll be nanofunguses. There'll be many things that will infiltrate, whether it's the roots of sprouts to make them look that they're not edible or other greens or whatever. There'll be many things that will happen. As long as we have free speech, information, and a way to exchange, whether it's by internet or TomTom, smoke signals telepathically, we will get the message out. You cannot improve on God, Gaia, Goddess, the Great Beyond. If you believe in any of that, or even if you're agnostic, you cannot improve on the package of a filbert. You cannot improve on the package of a fava bean. So these people, frankly, are godless. So what we have to do is show them the true God. The true nature of things is what we're given on this planet Earth. And as Pythagoras would say, as anybody would say, we have to deliver the truth. The truth is that the closer we are to the ground, the healthier we're going to be. So what we do in our outreach is we do a lot of private chefing and a lot of informing, and we get to the wives. We're now chefing for two executives, a Monsanto, for their wives, because their husbands are oink, oink, and the kids have autism. Seriously, and the mothers are on meds, and they want to know what to do. If we can affect the children, if we can affect the women who have the higher intuitive centers, we can maybe affect what they vote on the board. It's all about money, and if they knew they would make more money in the organic movement, which is trending upwards 8 times faster than the non-organic movement, or now it's the gluten-free movement, which is, if you do like Google AdWords or something, gluten-free is trending 10 times faster than organic. All these things are for commercialism. You know, you have rows and rows in your local supermarket of gluten-free products, this kind of thing. But the truth of the matter is, these are neurodisruptor products that are killing us. And eventually, lights will go on with the executives in the boardroom that the medical system is a flawed medical system. The food system is a flawed system. And if they kill off their customers, they do not have a sustainable business model. And so eventually, we get to them. And eventually, they will change. And they are us.
Amen. Got another caller on the line. Robert, like to hear from you this morning. Thanks for calling.
Well, I want to thank both of you for this show. I wish I'd had this information when I was 12. I wouldn't be a diabetic with high blood pressure and so on and so on right now. Mm. You're dead on about corporations. You know, the way out of it is to, first of all, shut off your TV.
Mm-hmm.
The corporations, if we believe that they exist in the way that they do, or the way we perceive them, we're enslaved to them, and you got to free yourself. But I greatly appreciate you bringing up all of the food security and food aspects of living a plant-based life. But the truth of the matter is, there's one plant that is banned from use out there. From everybody, and it is the single most useful plant as far as edibility, as far as making anything.
Mm-hmm.
Every single woe that our planet has, aside from, religion and ethnic hatred and whatnot, can be solved by one single plant. But the fact that we are banned from using it, banned from growing it, banned from having it compete with oil, banned from having it compete with pharmaceuticals on any real level.
Hey, what's your name again, bro? What's your name?
My name is Robert.
Robert, I just want to say something real quickly, because this is a huge topic. I'd like to spend the rest of the show on this topic, because you would not have a narco state in Mexico if this plant was not banned.
All of our woes.
And and you'd actually, I'm totally with you. Something about the 60s, and just stay on the line for a second. I'd like to keep talking. Something about the 60s is it was a grow-your-own kind of thing. And it was literally grow-your-own. And so even though we might have been a little dull in class, we were pretty illuminated in our meditations and our way of living. And we did not have the technology that we have now. So if you're growing hemp for fiber, you can't grow hemp for fiber even in America, two states. Okay, so we're getting our hemp from fiber from Canada via China and Romania. So you, and now Uruguay is a big fiber cultivar. So what happens is, and a big shout out to the Living Harvest people here who are located in this area, because we use a lot of their hemp seeds, which come from Manitoba, Canada, for essential fatty acids. Obviously, hemp seeds, high protein, omega 3, 6, 9, to help deliver nutrients into your system. I believe that if we had a grow-your-own culture, and if any Obama people are out there, he is actually more anti-legalizing it than we ever could have predicted. And we all voted him in. We believe that if we could legalize it, we could turn this thing around, bro. So you're right on the single most active thing to help the people in Mexico, the people in Brazil, the people around the world. Because we do not need heroin. We do not need cocaine. We do not need what I would consider to be the things that are killing us. Those drugs are only for like the really rich rock stars, like the Jim Morrisons or whatever of the world. And it's not only is it killing our humanity now, it's killing complete countries. So it's not a like just say no to drugs. It's kind of say yes to whatever is going to help the ails of humanity. And until they can make it into a spray, until they can make it into a little aerosol or whatever, so they can deliver it to the AIDS patients so that they, you know, can go through another day without the grief that they have. We're not going to have a legalize it campaign. I don't believe that. I think it's BS. I think we need to mount a stronger legalize it campaign. And unfortunately, the trending is opposite that. And it kind of baffles me because jobs, we deduce a quarter of a million jobs just in the fiber alone. The fuel, there might be a million jobs.
There, in my opinion, this country could completely rebound in a matter of two years at the very most.
You're on it, man, at the very most. Yeah.
Across the board, legalize the hemp aspect of it, we would definitely change things. One last thing I wanted to say before I let you guys go. Everybody's heard about the great seed bank going on in the Arctic Circle there. Realize that that is a partnership between Monsanto, either Monsanto or ADM, I think it's Monsanto, and the Seed Saver Exchange. Everybody loves the Seed Saver Exchange, but they went to bed with the devil this time. The problem is that for the backing to build this wonderful facility to save all of our seeds, which it cracks me up that Monsanto's is saving seeds that they can't make. they would go through the extra effort of saving.
Well, it's controlling the DNA. They want to control the DNA of all life forms.
You just nailed it, because right now, the deal that they have is within 3 years, Seed Savers has to sell off all of its stock, all of its...
Exactly, and also they're trying to wash their hands of it, and a lot of the money comes from the Gates Foundation. So if there's any Gates Foundation people out there, we do not need to vaccinate our humanity. We do not need to control the DNA to control the people. We need to feed the people so that people can be healed and be productive human beings to buy more software.
You guys keep up the good work, and have a wonderful day.
You too, bro.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number here is 503-231-8187. I'm Robin Shanti, and I'm speaking with Beau Rinaldi. We have another caller on the line. Hi, John.
Great show. I'm a proud member of KBOO, and if you like what you're hearing, please join, and we need some money. And my question is, I'm pretty ignorant of the vegan thing. I'm in my mid-60s, got a lot of health problems. One of the biggest ones that I encounter all the time is this IBS, so-called irritable bowel syndrome. And I'm sure contemplating switching over to more and more vegan stuff. And another question I've got is, do you have any bias towards, like, I know there was that fresh food movement and versus cooked? Thank you very much for a great show.
Thank you.
Another great question, man, and thanks for that. I'll definitely be writing another check here to KBOO, and obviously I'm on here for free, and it's free airwaves. We have to support the people. that bring the message. So thank you, Robin. Thanks to all the listeners. I would just say, first of all, it's never too late. One of the listeners said, you know, it's kind of, I wish I would have known this when I was younger. Well, it's never too late to reverse it. Actually, doing one good thing for yourself today will make tomorrow a better day. It's just the way that works. It sounds kind of hocus pocus, but it really works. I don't have any bias towards live food, raw food, cooked food. I wrote the book, A Complete Eater's Guide to Raw Food. I've been a raw foodist much of my life, actually, but I don't really like to engage in those conversations too much. There's a lot of mispropaganda there. There's a lot of uninformed information actually there. And while I speak on stuff, I don't really want to talk too much on that right now. Enzymes are in your live food, and enzymes also in cooked food to a certain degree. What you want to do is slowly replace bad habits with good habits. So let's see. What's a bad habit? Baked goods with a lot of gluten is what will cause IBS 9 times out of 10. So gluten is this gliadin protein. It's the longest chain protein on the planet. This protein has been hybridized 18 times. Even if it's organic wheat flour, the gliadin protein is, if you just had it out there, it's basically like a baseball bat. It is undigestible. So getting it out of the food system is important to eradicate autism, chronic fatigue, Crohn's, all these things. IBS is generally caused by this protein. It's undigestible. So that's number one. Number two is just go to a whole grain scenario. And the four grains you want to take in this order typically are quinoa, buckwheat, brown rice, and millet. There's no gluten in those. They're easily accessible. They could be $1 a pound. Buy yourself some nice organic quinoa, superfood of the Incans, right? And learn how to cook it out. Then make it, learn how to do bowls of food. Pythagoras said put it in a bowl, greens, grains, and protein. So steam your kale, put in a little bit of quinoa on top of it. Have some steamed veggies. Go with colors that you vibe, okay? If you vibe purple, go with purple. If you vibe orange, go with orange. Put in some yams, maybe a little bit of diced in tofu, not too much, no more than a few ounces. Have some greens, have some grains, have some proteins. Take baby steps to make good habits in place of bad habits. IBS is a function of a misplaced food system.
Thanks for your call. Really appreciate it. Now, if there's someone listening out there and they would like, you know, I think for people, I'll say myself, you know, I've been tempted and really curious about a vegan plant-based diet to begin with. And I'm always wondering, well, are there cooking classes out there? And again, you know, go back to the class issue. If someone's low income, they want to be able to stretch that dollar. And like you said, survive on $21. What is it? 20 bucks a week?
$21
per meal. Is there a website people can go to? Or
So I take emails. I love emails from people. My best email account is my name, Bo Rinaldi at Yahoo. So it's B-O-R-I-N-A-L-D-I at yahoo.com. Or Gmail or anything else, and Facebook and LinkedIn and all everything else. Our websites, you know, for Blossoming Lotus, obviously, is blpdx.com, and we give local classes with our head chefs here. And a shout-out to PCC. They support us a lot, and to the whole community that supports us. We obviously have veganfusion.com. Our executive chef literally travels around the world teaching heads of hotels and countries and spas how to do this. He travels around the world. He charges $1,500 for a two-week immersion course to take a Hilton hotel and turn it into a plant-based menu in a particular area. I think he's in Ireland this week or something. We filmed him, and we brought him here. We filmed him. We took the same manual that he produces for this class, as well as a lot of other free shizzle, right? And we did an all-encompassing course of like 21 lessons with download PDFs, all this stuff, and we sell it for $97, which could be a fortune to some people or not very much for others. We've sold, I think, maybe 1,000 memberships over the 4 months it's been out there because it's a good product. And that's at cookinghealthylessons.com. For people that are really interested in it, how to make flax crackers, how to make a bowl of food, how to do a rainbow salad. It's videos, it's recipes, it's free books, it's testimonials. We add to it every day. That's cookinghealthylessons.com. But if somebody can't afford to pay whatever and they're on food stamps or they need help, we're also part of a coalition, and this is me personally, for the next book that I want to do. I want to hear your recipes. What are you doing for survival? Because the next cookbook I want to do, and probably sell it for like $6 or something, the food stamp diet.
Love it. We've got one more call on the line. David, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning. Great show. I just wanted to put in a plug for portion control.
Mm.
I mean, I think that's a huge part, and I have a hard time with it myself.
Mm.
I find myself eating just a little more than I really need to, and I wonder if you have any ideas about that, how to deal with that. Perhaps, you know, I'm not on a totally vegan diet, but even though when I'm eating a vegan meal, everything's raw, I still want to just kind of pound out a little more than I really need.
Mm.
And I think it's a huge problem in our culture, and I was hoping you'd address that.
Great question. What's your name again?
David.
David. So here's kind of my take on that. I was raised as, let's say, the Sputnik generation, so my parents came out of the Depression. So if I didn't clear my plate, I could get whacked. And childhood, whatever it is, you know, abuse or whatever, I mean, they just take you out back. If you don't, like, finish your plate, right?
It's better than Jewish guilt.
And we're kind of like there's the all-you-can-eat program going on everywhere at any given time in America and actually around the world, right? So we're all kind of in abundance and we're all kind of in overuse. And the fact that we're having the conversation on portion control to me is profound, okay? If you're in India, it used to be a handful of rice. Now if you go into India, they're obese. Highest incidence of obesity and childhood onset diabetes, check it out, is in India.
Hmm.
Because food is our addiction. Okay, so the fact is with these biological machines taking these plant-based products, how weird is that, right? Pythagoras goes, it's assimilation, elimination. If you can't assimilate properly, you can't eliminate properly. So he said the whole system, this biological system, is all about assimilation, elimination. So when I look at myself, I am eating 10 times more than I probably need, honestly, literally. The food tastes so good. I'm like addicted to it sometimes. It's filling a void. Maybe there's something emotional going on I'm not even in touch with. I think we all have like quote-unquote food issues. So it's very good just to have the conversation, be aware of it, don't go for the extra plate, all of that, but also take a look at what is going on. Is this for nutrition? Is this for emotion? Or is there a food addiction? So the first thing we have to eradicate are food addictions. Sugar is the number one most addictive substance on the planet. Dr. David Kessler, and I'll give you a link to it if you like. Dr. David Kessler, two-time chairman of the FDA, could not say this in America. He had to go to the BBC. He said sugar is the most addictive substance on the planet, and because of the addiction of sugar, we will perish as a civilization. That's what he said. Just came out like a couple of months ago. Sugar's so addictive that I just say it, right? Everybody, what do you, you know, everybody wants their sweet. So it's sugar, fat, and salt. You put the three together, and you have something where you crave it. You have to have it. So if you go deep into the Amazon, wherever you go, and these people are like talking a language you've never heard, there will be a Coca-Cola machine there. Make no doubt about it. And that sugar, that energy, that addictive energy is turning them into basically puppets, okay, we like to call meat puppets. So what we have to do is really have a deeper conversation about this right now into ourselves. And I say mindfulness is what it's all about, eating like a Buddhist, feeling that it comes from the sky to the rain to the land to your body. And I am going to take your advice as well and watch my portions today.
Thanks for your call. We have another call on the line. Devin?
Hey, how's it going? Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
I'm heading off to class to PCC this morning and wanted to call in. I just got paralyzed less than a year ago.
Hmm.
And right when I was coming back after surgeries and stuff, I just had a huge craving for the fruits and vegetables. Didn't eat many grains because, even a hospital doesn't want you to do that. And I was really surprised by how the legacy manual system really pushed a very fruit and grain and greens diet. And I was very surprised for that being a hospital. I was thinking I was going to get little packaged meals. And I, I had great recovery. And since then, I've kind of been switching over. I've dropped my red meats out. My biggest question was fish. I know there's a lot of chemicals in the water, and I'm worried about the area and eating fish because I'm trying to uptake my fish and decrease my red meats. And my other last question was, what other foods do you know that would help with the re-stabilization of tissue and nerves?
Great questions, man. What was your name again?
Devin Sawicki.
Hi, Devin. So may I answer the question real quickly?
Yeah.
Okay, two statements. First of all, I like to see the hospitals turn into health spas. I like to see the hospitals turn into wellness centers. So would they. The payers can't pay them. The insurance providers can't. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Legacy, Providence, especially the Seventh-day Adventists, their outreach in food, plant-based food, is huge right now on recovery. They realize it costs less than meat, it doesn't spoil, it doesn't transfer disease, and lo and behold, it regenerates the body. Okay, What will regenerate your nervous system and what will regenerate your body will be adaptogenic plants. Okay, now I don't know if you can get your hands on any, like celery is one of the original ones because it's an ancient angelica, actually, Ashitaba. But celery, modern day celery, which is hybridized, is excellent for your nervous system. Obviously, carrots, do green smoothies, whole green smoothies where you put in an apple, a little bit of lemon, some kale, maybe some fresh herbs like sorrel, plantain, lamb's quarters, parsley, yep, basil, cilantro. These are neural regenerators for you. If you want to get more extreme, find yourself some ashwagandha. Ashwagandha, which you have to buy. It's an herb from...
Never heard of it.
It's an herb from India. Well, these are neural regenerators, okay? And if we have people that are extreme conditions that want to regenerate nervous systems, whole green-based smoothies, and, of course, the fresh green. Green is key, man. Green is what's up. The chlorophyll is basically analogous to your blood. We'll regenerate your nervous system.
Thank Devin.
You, Bo. And what was that again? B-O-R-I-A-N-A-L-D-Y at what?
Yeah, Bo Rinaldi. My name is Bo Rinaldi, so it's B-O-R-I-N-A-L-D-I at yahoo.com.
Thank you very much, Bo.
Yeah, man.
Thanks, Devin.
Have a good day.
One more call here. And by the way, we got about 7 minutes left. The number is 503-231-8187. I'm Robin Shanti, and we're talking with Bo Rinaldi. Heather, you're on the line.
Hi. I had a question. Years ago, I was vegetarian for like 15 years, and during that time, I've become anemic, and all the doctors I was seeing told me that I could no longer, including my acupuncturist, that I couldn't be vegetarian anymore. I was borderlining vegan, and honestly, I really like that lifestyle better, and I feel really gross eating meat, and I don't do it a lot, but can you be vegan and deal with anemia and not get sick, because I get really sick from it?
Good. Well, it's a really simple answer. It's a great question. So first of all, the idea of anemia is from iron, typically, and also the uptake of vitamins. So what you need to take a look at, the number one kind of way to reverse that is a plant-based lifestyle. It's not can you be. It's kind of like it's the only way, I believe, to reverse anemia. And we take a look at things like if somebody has extreme conditions of uptake, B juice, of course, and there's even one you can buy, Biota B juice, which is from Switzerland. It can reverse anemia in a couple of days, believe it or not.
But oh, wow.
Beets are amazing, number one. I still like kale and red things like pomegranate. Do you like the color red?
Yeah.
Watermelon.
Like beets and everything. Watermelon, yeah.
Watermelon, pomegranates, cranberries. Cranberries will reverse anemia for you very, very quickly. Local source of your iron and your uptake. Bioavailability is only available through a plant-based lifestyle. Vegetarians that are consuming a lot of dairy, vegans that are consuming a lot of soy. Yeah, you're gonna have disruptors in your system. So take a look at the red products. They'll all reverse anemia.
Okay, and what was that? Bio?
It's called Biota. If you have the catch, it's a few bucks. It comes from Switzerland. B-I-O-T-T-A. It's basically a lactobacillus beet juice from Switzerland that's used to reverse anemia in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy it at your local health food store. It's delicious. It's like a cocktail drink. You'll love it.
Oh, thank you so much, because I get so sick and I hate eating meat.
You'll blow your... I put my doc... And also, of course, wheatgrass juice, if you can handle it or put it into something. Wheatgrass juice will turn it around instantly for you. I put my doctor in this program because he had anemia. I put my father and his doctor on this program. He's a congressman, okay, in Oregon. And they do the test on anemia because he's like 87 years old. He goes, whatever your son is telling... That vegan son of yours, whatever he's telling you to do, you keep doing it. You're the healthiest 87-year-old I know.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
One more time, the number, 503-231-8187. And, Nate, you're on the line.
Hey, this is a really great show, and I really appreciate it. I just wanted to add one comment real quick. A lot of callers have been calling, talking about wanting to adopt the vegan or plant-based diet and about cooking classes and things like that. But let's also remember that a lot of things that we eat don't have meat and can be plant-based. Spaghetti. You can get, you know, you get good pasta, you make a good red sauce with fresh tomatoes, stuff like that. Then you've got non-meat, nothing weird, really easy, whip it right up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Lasagna with some sort of almond cheese sauce, which is kind of strange to make, but lasagna, everybody knows how to make that. it's hard to get off of the meat, and I encourage everybody that, you know, has the gumption to give it a shot. You can get a salad that it's hard to not eat meat.
Nice.
I just wanted to throw that out there. Don't be afraid. Don't wait for a cooking class.
I like it.
Just choose it.
All right,
I like it. Now, listen, our lasagna that we have at the Blossom Lotus, which is a really famous lasagna, we call it the Obama lasagna. It's a four-cheese lasagna, right? It's all plant-based, obviously, and there's also a new cheese that's out called Daiya cheese. I don't work for them or whatever. It's cassava-based. It's actually really cool and inexpensive, and the Food Fight people would be happy to get it over to you, and we're really happy to be able to serve it as well. Don't be afraid to cook. Cooking is alchemy. Get the kids in the kitchen. It transformed for me being in the kitchen. Light some candles, put on some music, do a grow-your-own thing, whatever you need to do to set the Shanti vibe of the kitchen. The kitchen is the laboratory. It's an alchemical process. So right on, bro.
All right. We've got time, I think, for one more caller. Steve, you're on the line.
Call again. If you need assistance, dial your operator.
Whoops, looks like we lost Steve. We'll try one more time. That's okay. Hi, Steve. Are you on the line?
Pardon?
Oh, go ahead with your question. Sorry.
I was just trying to connect with somebody there because they said that, you know, you're out of time for me to talk to him. But I have a background in training and development, and I just want to get involved with what he's doing. And I'm wondering if I could leave a phone number you could pass on to him.
Well, you're actually on the air, so why don't you ask Bo your question directly here?
Wonderful.
Don't give your phone number on the air, you know?
No, I won't do that. I was not aware. At any rate, to cut to the chase, I've recently been involved with some people that are doing amazing things with mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And have come in contact with somebody that is, deeply involved in that with Paul Stamets connection.
Right, good, and I'm into it. In the interest of time, do you have my email, borinaldi@yahoo.com? B-O-R-I-N-A-L-D-I at yahoo.com. I'm deeply involved in mushrooms. I'm kind of known for nutraceutical research is what I do. We help launch the reishi mushroom and obviously extracts of mushrooms. I'm very into a mushroom called lion's mane right now. Mushrooms are neither plant nor animal, right? They're fungus, and they have vascular systems closer analogous to our body. So I'd love to work with you on what you're talking about.
Oh, well, I am so excited. I am just incredibly passionate about this, and I want to get involved with what you're doing.
Good. In the interest of time, I'm going to have to cut you off because she's signaling me. I'm also available, info@blpdx.com. So Blossoming Lotus is blpdx.com, info@blpdx.com.
Okay, Bo, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come to KBOO today. Again, that's Bo Rinaldi, R-I-N-A-L, it's B-O-R-I-N-A-L-D-I at yahoo.com. I'm Robin Shanti.